So, welcome to Making It Small in Music with Barker and Brasky. I'm Chris Brasky, and I am here. I'm here because my dreams of musical stardom are dead, and I love it. It is great, and you should do that too. And I'm here with my partner,
you know,
Mike.
And I'm here. Hey, I'm here because,
hey,
you know, Chris and I are, you know, rocking and rolling together and having a good time. And, you know, it seemed like such a fun time to sit and talk to some good friends and then some other people about their musical journeys.
Hold on, is that what we're doing today? I mean, I heard this thing was Making It Small in Music. I thought this was like a weight loss program. I had an agenda. Man, that's not going to work.
I'm sorry, Dave, but if you look at Mike and I, you know we do not have any good advice.
And the
we
voice
are rocking
you just heard.
The middle-aged dad bod, so, you know.
The voice you just heard was our special guest, Mr. David Roof of Rooftop Recording.
Thanks so much, guys, for inviting me on.
Man, you are our first real guest. And
woohoo!
Yeah, I know. Mike and I interviewed ourselves. We figured we should practice a little before foisting this upon real people. And, you know, there's no better person I could think to ask. Dave is our dedicated engineer and pro that helps Mike and I out with recording and everything music related that Mike and I are not quite capable of doing. I really appreciate it.
I think you undersold that, Chris. I'm not even remotely capable of the things David can do.
Oh, well, man.
Well, I didn't want to, you know, let's not nitpick about whatever. I mean, I plugged in a mic before, and as far as I could tell, I did it as well as Dave. So,
and I've heard Michael's recordings off the little Tascam or the computer interface too. So, you know, you got some skills there.
He does.
I can press record.
That's step number one.
That's what it's all about.
That's right.
So anyhow, it's exciting to have Dave here because Mike and I are amateurs. We do get paid occasionally, sometimes to stop playing.
That's right.
but our friend David Roof pays all of his bills with this, and I have got a lot of questions about how the heck to do that.
Yeah, 8 years without another day job. That's it's the longest run I've ever had.
You are living the dream.
I guess the dream or the nightmare, you know, somebody else can tell that.
If it wasn't hard, you wouldn't have to charge for it.
Yeah, that's true.
So, speaking of dream, when did your musical dream start? Were you into music when you were just a little shaver?
Yeah, I think if you ask my parents when the whole thing started, when I was in second grade, they bought me a Magnus air organ. I don't know if you know what that thing is, but
no
it's
clue.
Is it like an air guitar?
No, it's like a Magnus organ was a little thing. It's really like an electric harmonium, right? So it's a reed organ that you plug into the wall. There's a little fan that blows the air, and then you press the keys and that, you know, plays melody notes. And then there's another set of keys that were like chord buttons, like you'd have on an accordion. And the books all had numbers for the melody and the chord names. And you would just have to like read the line above, and there would be the chord button to play. And then the numbers would tell you what note to play on the keyboard. And I used to play with that thing like crazy. And, you know, I taught myself to play the Michigan Fight song, which... Yeah. You know, that was like a number one thing to do on any musical instrument was play the old fight song. And then, you know, through school, it was the recorders in fourth grade, school band in fifth grade. And
you played trumpet, didn't you?
Did you start with
trumpet?
Cornet. Technically cornet. Yeah. which it's a trumpet by another slight difference in shape and name, but, yeah. And the funny thing was, it was the days where Marshall Music used to send somebody around to everybody's house to like try out the kid for what instrument they would be good for. And now later on in life, just to jump ahead, I worked for Marshall Music and I learned the truth of that, which is that those people that go around to everybody's house their real job is to make sure that the school gets a band that's balanced with the right numbers of all the right instruments. Mm. So, and you know, and they do want to make sure that, like, if you can't make a sound on the flute, that you don't play the flute, right? Mm. So there has to be some level of ability to be successful. Like, can this kid hold the thing the right way?
Right.
And, yeah, but we all just did that in the music room. They just had us try everything, whatever. I think we spent a couple of days doing that.
Okay.
So, and yeah, every boy wanted to play the trumpet and every girl wanted to play the flute. So they had to start shaving those away.
Yeah, I did not want to play the trumpet. First thing I wanted to play was drums, and my parents instantly said, no way. And then I said, okay, well, how about the saxophone? Nope. Trombone? No. So, like, triangle? What's left out of instruments? what's left? What else could I play? You could play the cornet. Okay, great. What's that? So I got placed on the cornet, not having a clue what it was. And by the end of fifth grade, their parent teacher conferences, my mom came in and the band director said, yeah, he's doing really well. He plays pretty good. And you might want to consider getting him lessons because he shows real promise. So, okay, why not? So
these humble beginnings.
Yeah. Right. So I started taking private lessons from a kid who was either a senior in high school or had just graduated. And he was like the first chair trumpet player at the high school. And he started showing me, you know, a little bit more about how to play the trumpet. And also he introduced me to jazz. Oh. Yeah, and took me to my first concert. It was the coolest thing ever. I went to see Maynard Ferguson.
Oh,
what?
At the Tecumseh High School Auditorium. No, that was Chuck Mangione.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Oh, Maynard, he's a monster, man. That guy, wow.
Yeah, the original trumpet screamer, right? Played all the high notes. And at the end of the concert, his encore was the theme to Rocky. And my parents gave me permission to go to the concert with my private teacher, who was, you know, a kid himself by all real ways, seemed much older and more mature to me because he was like, you know, 6 years older than I was.
Right.
On the way home, like, wow, did you know he was going to play the theme to Rocky? And he said, yeah, that's his hit. He played the movie. He did all the soundtrack for that movie. And that was him. When you saw the movie, that was him playing the trumpet. And my jaw just like hit the floor. Like, wow, he could do that at somebody's high school and put on this show. And that's his living. That's what this guy does. And that was it. I wanted to be a musician right from that very instant.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's a great story. Maynard Ferguson. Yeah, I could see how you got sold by that.
Man. Right. Yeah.
My grandfather was a trumpet player. And, I chose the saxophone instead. Big mistake. I should have gone for trumpet.
Sax is a pretty cool instrument. I still wish I'd played the saxophone.
Yeah, it's good if you. The problem is, I don't know. I had a lot of canker sores, and playing woodwinds when your mouth is bleeding
was not so cool.
Is brass better for canker sores? This is the real question. So.
I don't know. I never got them, thankfully, so I wouldn't be able to say. But I bet if you got cold sores, you know, on the outside of your lip, it would have been really bad.
That would be brutal. But, oh my God. So you went to college for cornet. Was it still cornet at that point?
No. So, shortly after I started taking private lessons, I did my first experience outside of school was Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp. They're still around, been around for more than 50 years now.
They absolutely are.
Yep. My daughter's been there 5 times or something crazy like that. And my first year I went and did the middle school jazz band, and we played Feels So Good, the Chuck Mangione hit. I was still playing a cornet at that point. And I think when I came home from that summer, my private teacher said, yeah, you're probably ready to step up to an actual trumpet. So I switched to the trumpet, which really it's the same instrument in most practical ways. It's a little brighter sounding. It's tubular bore instead of conical, but you know.
So what, it's a, like a little harder to play, is that?
No, it's harder to get a good tone out of. Like cornet is always a big full round tone just because of the conical bore. It's like related as an instrument slightly more towards the French horn, which is also a conical bore. The okay. cylindrical bore, right, like the tubing itself, this,
it's all like it's, one diameter of tubing, you're saying,
until the very last piece, until the bell. Yeah, so a trumpet is all tubular, sorry,
it's like not, you could just make some out of a bunch of pipe.
Yeah, yeah. So and then I went to a number of different summer programs throughout the years. I did Blue Lake twice. I did Interlaken's National Music Camp, which at the time was 8 weeks. And then I went out to Tanglewood in Massachusetts, which is the summer program with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And I studied brass quintet with a professional performing group called the Empire Brass Quintet. And that really, I think, was the thing that like solidified the skills that I needed to audition for college and really feel like that was the right path for me. And
so you're a teenager here playing in wind ensemble and whatever.
Yeah.
What about your love for rock and roll? How did that mesh with the academic music, I guess you could
start,
call it?
Didn't you start listening to that Fabulous Four from Liverpool?
Well, yeah, but that wasn't my first inspiration to play the guitar. The first thing that made me want to play the guitar, or yeah, maybe it was the actual thing that did it. There was a movie, Crossroads. It had the Karate Kid.
With Ralph Macchio.
Ralph Macchio. And Stevie Vai.
Right. So I saw that movie, and I might have, I think when I was at Blue Lake, there was a kid who played guitar, and it made me think it was cool. And I got one, but didn't really know what to do with it. And then I saw that movie, and I'm like, yeah, that's what I want to do. So it was the blues stuff that really spoke to me. So I got a slide and like started to figure out, you know, more of what to do. And I was from a little town. So there was like one kid who played guitar, Dundee. And yeah, just this one other guy who played guitar, and he was like a metalhead and way cooler than I was, so he wouldn't have had anything to do with me anyway.
Right.
But yeah, it was really that. It was wanting to play blues slide guitar that got me going. And then I started to appreciate the Beatles very shortly after, and it was like working my way through learning every Beatles song on every Beatles album that really like taught me to play the guitar. And it was my escape from all the like serious classical stuff, right? Like I was just teaching myself guitar.
Yeah. There is no agenda, you know, learn this scale and that and the other thing. You're just making music.
Right. And of course, because I was doing all that stuff on the trumpet, I actually did end up, you know, using scales, and I learned music theory really young. And that was what I used to teach myself. It was like, okay, well, I know what a major chord is. That's a major third and a minor third. So let me figure out all the ways that I can do that on the fingerboard of the guitar. And this
is why I recommend young people take advantage of their music, your school music. I mean, it's not cool. I know it's not cool, but you're going to learn how to read music. You're going to learn so many skills that transfer to anything, you know?
Yeah. And even with all that private instruction that I was doing from like starting in sixth grade, it was my high school band director who gave me the music theory books. It was like a teach yourself series. And I went to him in eighth grade and said, yeah, I'm bored in school bands. Can I join the high school band now? And he said, shut up, kid, go away and work on this stuff. And
nice.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, he didn't say it quite so brusquely, but almost. And
yeah, I just went down to the library, checked out some music theory books, you know. I'm surprised they don't teach that in music in school, that we both had to sort of search it out on our own.
They still don't. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. That's like the academic part of music. You'd think it'd be part of the the curriculum for a school music program.
Not to mention how many kids would probably love to write their own songs and whatever. And it's not that hard. Music theory sounds hard. I know Mike's just starting to pick it up now, and it seems very scary. How's it going, Mike? Have you...
See, I'm not afraid of it. I'm just looking forward to integrating it into my long-term memory.
Right. Which,
you know,
And then you get to have the struggle that we all have once learning music theory, which is to remember that there are only rules that were like written to say what people already did, and they don't really have much to do with what you want to create. It might give you a better understanding of the framework, but yeah, then you got to ignore it all.
That's an argument I have online a lot with people. There, like, there's a, on Reddit has a music theory subreddit, and it is so many people are like, explain why this chord progression sounds good. And I'm like, music theory can't tell you how something sounds good any more than grammar can tell you if a poem is good. You know, it's just structure and language. Music theory is a great way to think about music. But it's, there's not one right way, and it is not Mad Libs. It is not based by number.
I got to tell you, though, it's really helped me understand some things that you guys say.
Yes, communication is so good. You know, somebody yells out, hey, we're playing an A minor, and you know what notes those are. It's going to help a lot.
It helps a
lot. Dude, it's a six chord, not a four chord. Come on, it's a six.
Wait, how many chords are there? I'm playing a seven and a half? Oh, that is cool. So when did you get in a rock band? When did you finally take that plunge?
Well, I had a sort of a rock band my sophomore year of high school. And more so, I moved to Adrian halfway through high school. And
the big city?
The big city of Adrian. Yeah, the county seat, man. Yeah, there was a lot happening there. And in comparison, there really was like Adrian had two bands in school and an orchestra and like at least two choirs. And my high school had such an anemic music program that I don't think we had a choir at all. And there was one band with about 50 people in it, and that's it.
Moving up.
Yeah. So there was a lot in Adrian, and that, and I met guy who was a friend of mine for a number of years that was a bass player and guitar player, and we started playing with various musicians. And Adrian High School used to host a yearly battle of the bands, and we did that. They had rock bands playing at the pep assemblies in the spring and the fall, and I got to do one of those my senior year. And
you played at the battle of the bands and you were a sophomore?
No, that would have been my junior or senior year. And, you know, we were pretty terrible, but
I got to ask what song you played. Do you
remember? Well, man, it each band got like a 20-minute set, so we could play multiple songs. And like I said, we were sort of like fishing, grasping at straws for like, who doesn't have a band already? Like, who are the leftovers? And there was this guy who did Elvis impersonation, and he was willing to do the show. We backed an Elvis impersonator, and it was me and my other buddy who were playing the guitar and bass, switching off between songs, I think. And then we had a drummer, another percussionist who did like I guess near the end of his career, Elvis did like this big entry that was like the 2001 Zarathustra entrance with the timpani and the whole shot. Right. Bom, bom, bom,
yeah, the bom. Las Vegas Elvis.
And we did all that, and we had a guy who played the timpani on stage with us. And
oh my god, that's epic.
Yeah, it was Elvis, pretty crazy.
Tell you what, you can never go wrong with an Elvis impersonator, man.
Well, we didn't really go right either, but we took third out of five, so, you know, strictly middle of the pack at that point.
Could be worse.
Yeah, right.
That's better than sixth.
And then shortly after that, when I was a senior in high school, we met this guy, Michael Snyder Barker.
I know
Michael
him.
Barker at the time.
Yeah.
And he played drums with us. So we did a trio for a while. And then we had a couple of different people that came and went on guitar, as I remember. But the at the end of it was John Lowe, who's right. Michael's bandmate in... Hang on, I've got someone knocking at my door. Sorry about this.
Right. That's all right. We can I can edit it out.
Yeah, I don't know why I've got door knocking going on.
I like the Dutch angle, though. Feels like I'm watching old Batman.
Here, I'm Jess's husband. Can I use your bathroom real quick?
Jess?
Did she just came in to buy a plant?
Oh, yeah. Can you hit the front door? Yeah, sorry, I've got, I'm on a Zoom meeting right now. Sorry about that. My wife has somebody over doing something, and
didn't we have John Ward for a little bit too, or was that later?
Oh, I'm sorry. Wrong
was
name.
It John Lowe?
John Ward, no. Not John Lowe.
Oh, no, hold on. Or no, was I it think it was Lowe.
John Lowe was in. You know, he was going to replace you as you went to college, but I didn't know if.
Boy, I don't know. It's so hazy. I mean, that's going back.
This was a long time ago.
And, you know, I was
in a galaxy.
Yeah.
John Lowe was at the very end.
Yeah. I think maybe it was both of those guys.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yeah. It's really.
It's that's, fuzzy.
We're going we're back digging. To the. These are the yeah, deep cuts.
That would have been in like 1990.
Yep.
So, yeah, back a little ways.
Yeah, a couple of years. And yeah, hey, what I wondered was when did you really start your love of recording your own original music?
I got this book, and well, this isn't going to video, so I guess visual props aren't really needed, but I still have it. It's called The Beatles Recording Sessions. Mm-hmm. And it was a. Day-by-day account of everything the Beatles did in the recording studio. And it had like the studio setup charts that they would hand off to the assistant engineers to set microphones and instruments in place before the sessions. And it would show like all the different microphones that they used. And, mm-hmm. and it was just, you know, stories of how the Beatles recorded. And I learned that they did all of that on a four-track machine, and this was in the 1980s, right? So in the 1980s, a four-track machine meant a cassette recorder that allowed you to record left and right channel from side mm-hmm. one and side two all working together, so you had four different slots to record on, which ultimately is the same sort of thing, but the four-track machines the Beatles were using, the tape was 1 inch wide, it was manufactured by the German Studer Corporation, and it was like, you know, serious great gear, but I didn't know, so I figured, oh, I can get a cassette four track and I can start making my own records.
That's right.
And we did. That's we somewhere under contractual threat of death, those four tracks still exist in the world.
What? And,
yeah, they're out there somewhere. But
thankfully all my stuff is missing.
so is mine. That's what I meant to say.
You can't prove it exists.
Someone here might have a copy still, but let's move on.
Yeah.
It's true. You know what? When I'm looking for old music, I ask Mike. He keeps all of that stuff. So look out. Blackmail time.
Yeah, so I wrote a bunch of songs back then that were all not very good. And my parents, when I moved to Adrian, I was pretty upset because, you know, I'd spent all my life in Dundee, and junior and senior year, right? The crowning years of your youth, yeah. I had to start over in a new town, right. Which I was not happy about. So part of the deal was, well, this new house has a nicely finished basement, and I wanted to have a little home recording music room made.
Studio.
And yeah, so there were books where they like talked about like take carpeting and hang it in front of the wall, and that works well for sound insulation. So yeah, I made a whole music studio out of like half of the basement workshop that had been in the house. And, and I made all kinds of recordings there. So that, yeah, it would have been my junior year of high school when I got that recorder and started into it.
I bet those old recordings don't sound as bad as you think.
Oh yeah.
I guess your standards are probably higher than ours. You know, we come in to record with you and you're like, yep, it sounds good. You know, and you hear all the imperfections and you're like, okay, I won't tell them. That'll just be more work.
you know, that would have been years and years of creating imperfections to hear is why I hear that stuff.
Well, yeah, like at least 31, 32 years of recording experience. Certainly. That,
yep.
You know, you've put a lot into it.
Yeah. And, you know, by my sophomore year of college, I had some friends that had a band and I was still rocking the four track at that point. And they knew that I was like, you know, I was in music school and I had a four track and they had heard some of the later four track tapes that I had made and they thought they sounded really good. So they brought their four track cassettes to me to mix, you know, because I was going to help their cassette four track sound better, which now, you know, it sounds kind of crazy to me, but that was my first paid recording gig. I think I got $25 to mix like four or five songs for them for a cassette four track EP release.
That's not too shabby.
Yeah, it's got to start somewhere.
Yeah. No, I had a little one of those cassette recorders as well. And it was fun, but yeah, my it does not sound good. I'm so glad everything's on computer now. It's so much easier.
Yep. Yep. Everybody longs for those magical heyday of analog tape, and I gotta say, even bad digital is way better than what we were getting back then.
Yeah, maybe if you had that Beatles 1-inch tape, it'd be great. But
yeah, yeah.
I had a chance to do some mixing of some of Soylent Green, Edgar Allan's Toe music Chris was involved with, and man, I did such a terrible job that I kind of buried and lost Chris's guitar on one song. It's kind of eerie. It's in the back, you know, and it's
the
still
ghost
there,
of
but
my
it's
guitar.
Yeah, right? It was. I think it sounds interesting, but I really screwed it up. I was, you know,
I noticed when a drummer does mixing, you hear is the drums. It's crazy. Well,
right, right.
Yeah, I don't hear. Is there a problem with that?
Yes, because I'm a guitarist, and when I mix, all you hear is guitar. So
that's right.
Yeah.
But that's why Dave's a multi-instrumentalist. I hope you don't play favorites, you know.
Right.
Well, that is part of the gig, is to try to make everything really balanced and listen like a listener, not like a musician.
Right.
That is what kills me. Do you have any advice, like, especially even when I first started and even now, like, I listen to it and very quickly I can't even tell if it sounds better or worse. If it sounds good or bad. It seems, you know, if you're just listening on the radio or to somebody else's music, it's so obvious. But when you listen to your stuff, it's like, I can't tell.
Right. So, yeah, I think one of the most valuable tools for that is when you're working on recording and trying to, you know, improve your skills for tone is reference recordings, right? Mm-hmm. Like, every time you listen to music, if you find something and you're like, oh, this song has the absolute coolest rhythm guitar, or like the bed of instruments in the background is the coolest thing I've ever heard, I throw it into a playlist as a reference track. Or, wow, this is really interesting. It's got a lot of low end and like really good low end, and it's the most that I've ever heard in this genre. So I'm going to put that in as a reference just for like... And each thing that I pick, it's like picking something for a specific reason. Like I keep Rolling Stones, I forget which track from Exile on Main Street, it almost doesn't matter, but some song from Exile on Main Street is in my reference library, not because the recording sounds particularly great or hi-fi, But that mix, the vocal is so quiet that that's like my reference of how quiet can I make the voice before it's too quiet. Right. And then it's, and I don't do this as much anymore because I've sort of got a good understanding where these things should be. But, you know, the first 30 years of my recording career, it was listening back and forth from reference tracks to what I'm working on to, and just being really, really critical about like, well, that's how that sounds. Now let me listen to mine and then trying to figure out what is it, why is it that mine doesn't sound like that? And in really, you know, specific instrument by instrument, like, you know, bass and treble and volume and magic of the sound, whatever, like each instrument, where does it sound right and where does it not sound right?
That makes a lot of sense. All right, I'll do that. You know, I guess I shouldn't be reinventing the wheel. I mean, how many great songs have all been already been recorded? Just do what they're doing, you know?
Right.
So could we talk, give me some information on, you said 8 years, music is your day job. How, if it's me, I guess I'm thinking maybe even for retirement or whatever, you know, I can start doing that. What are some good ways to make money and enjoy playing music at the same time?
So over my professional and semi-professional career, because it's been both at different times, there's been a bunch of different things. So at first it was playing with various established music entities and getting paid to do it. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing, like find a band that's out gigging and someone's already doing the organizing and join it and play. Mm-hmm. So
everyone needs a bassist and you can always jump in, you know?
Right. Right. And people always need background singers. So like whatever instrument, oh, well, we don't really need another guitar player, but they sing really well. So, that's always an avenue, but yeah, I played like in the local, Croswell Opera House Pit Orchestra. And I played in a jazz band called the 251 Orchestra, run in Ann Arbor by a guy named David Swain, who's still doing it. Mm-hmm. I was like the 20th guitar player for Frank Allison and the Odd Sox at one point.
Right.
So there's always that, right? Just like find a group and audition or get to meet them and join. Mm-hmm. And with the recording, I think the real key there is once you've made some really good sounding recordings, people are going to come to you and say, whoa, that was cool. I want my recording to sound like that. Mm-hmm. I got lucky early on. I was friends with some people I worked at Herb David Guitar Studio in Ann Arbor back in the 90s. And I met a lot of people there. And one of the guys who was teaching guitar also had a part-time gig engineering at a recording studio called Al's Audio Diner, which was a little project studio in the back of the world-class tape duplication building. Mm-hmm. And I had been, you know, frustrating myself trying to make music with these hippie guys that I knew who had a loft in Ypsilanti. And he invited me and said, hey, why don't you just come do sessions at Al's? Whoa, if you'd let me do that, if you think I could get in there, sure, I'd love to. Mm-hmm. So kind of the same thing with the band. Like I found a studio that needed somebody and got an opportunity to get the door open. A lot of recording studios, if they have an actual like building, like my studio now is in my home. So I'm not opening up my studio for anyone else to work in because it's my home.
Right.
But if I had a commercial building, and any studio that is in a commercial space, they're usually looking for all kinds of engineers to come and work. Mm-hmm. And the key there is you're only probably going to work for the most part if you find somebody who wants to come work with you at that studio. Right. So it's sort of opened the door to let me have a chance to hustle up my own work. And I got a couple of things, like mostly handoffs when somebody didn't want to work with somebody.
They would hand them to me. Difficult musicians.
Oh man, I won't tell the stories out of respect for their anonymity, but well, yeah.
You can change the names. I mean, Mike and I, who are talking, we are talking about like some of our worst gigs and whatever. Hilarious.
Two quick ones. I'll give you the short version. There was the guy who was a cab driver in Ann Arbor who came in, and he was introduced as a multi-instrumentalist, and he came in, and, you know, if he wasn't drunk when he showed up, he sure seemed like it. Like maybe he had been drunk for 20 years before. And he said, okay, well, I want to play guitar now. And he would play for like 10 minutes of just this rambling stuff that never really developed a beat. And I would set up a click track for him and it wouldn't follow the click at all. It was just sort of all over the place. And he would finish. And I'm sitting there thinking like, what was that? What? And I'd ask him, well, hey, how'd you feel about that? What, you want to do another one? No, set up a bass. So I'd, you know, throw the bass rig together, put up a mic on it. And then he'd go back to what he had just played on guitar and play bass that didn't even match what he just did on the guitar.
Pretty avant-garde stuff.
Right. Well, I don't know. And I don't know that any of it ever came to see the light of day, but he had a good time doing it. So, and there was this other guy who came in with an entourage of people and never came in during the day. I was like the third shift guy. So I would get any session that would start like 8 o'clock or later. And then I'm working with the guy for a while and it was described as ambient gothic vampire techno. And
you know, that's my favorite music.
Right. So one time he shows up at the studio and he's literally got fangs. Like he had gone to some makeup specialist. And I actually took that one far enough that I played on stage with him once and got all made up and I like borrowed a black Les Paul and dressed in all black. And the stage show was something else. For a short while there was like a vampire themed club in Detroit, like right around what was that lady's name? Anne Rice. Is that the author that wrote Vampire List?
Vampire Diaries.
Yeah. Mm. So there was a club that came up just after that. That was like the Vampire Club. And we did a show there and like, he got wheeled up to the stage in a coffin and came out of the coffin to start the show. But yeah, that was like the start that I got was, you know, here, kid, take these guys, go make some music.
You get the odds and ends. Oh, that's oh my gosh. I bet that vampire show probably went pretty well at the Vampire Club.
Yeah, I have to say I was a little bit freaked out enough that I didn't stick around real long afterwards.
Did you wear a like a turtleneck?
Yeah, protect your neck.
I should have.
Oh my gosh, that's so great.
So what are some of the aspects of your musical journey that you just have found great joy in, where, you know, you've got some stories of you know, recording people or playing with people or sometimes just sitting and talking to people between sets? Anything special or unique you want to share?
Boy, there's so much. I mean, it's so hard to pare it down to a story because frankly, I'm really lucky. You know, I get to wake up in the morning and music production generally doesn't start real early in the day. So I get to start my day nice and slow and easy with a cup of coffee, preparing for my long 10-step commute from my living room. And then I get to work on all this music that I'm not making commercials. You know, I'm not making a jingle for Applegate Chevrolet or whatnot.
Right.
I'm actually working on original music with people constantly. And
yeah, real honest music. Yeah. It's that must be nice. Yeah. Cause it isn't just like, how do I make a buck? You know, good, bad, whatever. I know all the people I know that record with you, they're doing it out of sense of passion.
Right.
And
I'm just truly, everybody always says, oh, I'm so blessed, but I'm extremely, extremely fortunate to be able to do what I do and to have sort of found a niche of helping singer songwriters and up and coming bands get their stuff out because I love it. You know,
yeah.
people will ask, like, well, what sort of credits have you got on AllMusic, or what sort of major label releases have you worked on? I'm like, I don't care. I don't know. I don't care. I don't even know how to find the website. It's not part of my world, and that's okay.
Because Dave, but, you are making it small in music.
Exactly.
That's it. That is it. It's, yeah, I am making the small time, and I love it. It's, you know, it's fun to do things like get award nominations. And, I got my first one for the studio this year for the Detroit Music Awards, the Whiskey Charmers, who, I've recorded all of their records, have won two now on their last two records. And, a number of other clients have gotten nominated, sometimes for recording, sometimes for their songwriting. And that's cool. It's a great honor, but again, I don't really care. You know, it's just, it's nice to know that enough people noticed about it, that it got the nod for a nomination. Like that's cool. Like music is actually being heard by somebody.
Do you think like the new way that we're sort of consuming music, do you think it's more welcoming for what you do? 'Cause you don't have to go through like distribution channels, or I don't know. Did we lose something too?
I think that it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
There's no longer really the hope of getting major labels to make a career for you. You're not going to find somebody that's going to break you through. They're looking for people that are already established and already doing it, that they can sort of ride the coattails of and maybe push another level further, but they're not looking for undiscovered, unknown people to sort of nurture into artists. So that part is gone. But the other side of it is that everybody has access to these services where everyone's listening, right? Like anyone can get their music on Spotify.
Right.
Anyone can get their music on Apple Music, iTunes, YouTube.
Yep. If Mike and I can, anybody can.
The trick is getting people to hear it.
Right.
But so, now we have social media, so it's not like you have to pay for radio ads or whatever, or, you
right.
know, I don't, what did they do in the 70s? Give cocaine to the program manager? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think there's some of that. And the other thing is that record companies, to get new artists, they would have the end caps in the record stores, right? Like you go into the record store and it's the hot new release at the end of the row that everyone is going to see. And those spots were actually paid for. And right. So there's that
so
sort of
you could
thing.
Be you in Kmart, you could get a really prominent place to put your record albums.
Yeah. All those people that were up on the top display, right? The row up above.
Yeah. Oh,
those are all, that's all paid positions.
I did not realize that.
And the same thing to an extent still happens. There are people that are curators for playlists that expect people to, you know, give them some financial support in order to get written about.
Yeah, we're not going to get away from that too fast.
Right. There's services where if you want to show that you're doing well, you can buy plays. You can pay people with server farms to stream your song on a playlist with 100 other clients 24 hours a day. And without going out and playing shows, without doing anything, you can get, you know, 10, 100,000, a million plays, depending on your budget. And
why though?
That's the question.
Point of that?
Yeah, because then when the real people who are like actually looking for what's hot and what's interesting see that, and then they start to go looking for who you are and what you do,
right?
They see that there's no meat to it, and it's all
pretty thinly veiled. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I hear Spotify periodically, you know, they'll just kick out tens, hundreds of thousands of artists because they catch them pulling that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's hard to track when you put playlists together, with enough variety of artists and randomize it geographically, where you've got somebody's closet with 10 old PCs going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's it's a lot harder to catch than a whole thing happening all in one spot.
You know, I would much rather have somebody listen to the music than to kind of do it that way, because
yeah,
that way people aren't really listening.
No, right. No. It's just, I don't know. What, do you get to show it off to your mom or something?
Right.
Like, Mom, I got 10,000 listens. Who cares?
I have the Rolling Stone going through my head now.
On the cover of the
Rolling Stone.
Is that still around?
Rolling Stone is.
Yeah.
I mean, magazines still exist a little. I think they do on stuff online and whatever.
Yeah, probably. But what are you up to these days, Dave?
Well, making a bunch of records. Just starting to go out and play a few more gigs again.
Yeah.
Is the Invasion back online?
Yeah, so the Invasion is not currently going on.
The Invasion is canceled.
The Invasion got repelled. So for anybody who might be listening to this who doesn't know me and the things that I do, I run a recording studio out of my home called Rooftop Recording. I have my main band. The band that I organize is the Invasion, and it does all sort of a genre band of anything 60s from England. Mm-hmm. I have a partner that I just founded a marketing business with called South Main Street Marketing. And I've got this great partner who lives near DC, grew up here in Michigan, and it was mutual contacts that sort of we got connected through. And
That makes so much sense, because we were just talking about it's like, now how do you promote this stuff on the new media and whatever? Mm-hmm. There you go.
Right.
Steph is great.
I was going to say, in the sense of full disclosure, Barker Broski are clients of South Main Street Marketing.
That's right.
And it's excellent. Yeah, no, we really like Steph. She's really talented, and she's
doing a great
giving
job.
Us direction that we need so bad.
and really, it's all the stuff that we were sort of touching on of, like, how do you work social media to find people to actually listen to the music? You know, how do you connect with human beings? I could direct people to where to go to find server streams that give you plays and nothing else. And, you know, I've seen the menus of how many plays do you want to get? How many impressions do you want to make for how much money? But I'm not interested in that. So we're trying to provide services to do the sort of support work that back in the day, back in the day, the record company would pay to get you placed on the end caps. And the record companies don't do any of that kind of stuff for anybody really anymore.
Get on the Instagrams or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's part of the thing, like coordinating the social media, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok. And
that's so big right now. Though I think it's because I don't think they've dealt with copyright at all.
I
think it's all copyright free, but that day is coming.
Right.
But
yep, all they need to do is get one good lawsuit threatened and the gig is up.
That's right.
Yeah,
you got that going. You got a couple other groups that you're a mainstay in, right?
Yeah, I play a lot with the Judy Banker Band. I've been playing bass for a singer-songwriter out of Ann Arbor, Dick Siegel. Mm-hmm. Been playing with him for like 22 years now.
Yeah.
I play in a rockabilly trio called Nobody's Business. I've been doing that for like 20 years. And I was gigging a lot. Like at one point I had 12 bands that I was part of.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was a Google Calendar fiasco of just trying to make sure that everything got on the calendar and didn't get missed. And I decided over quarantine that I just don't want to do that anymore. So any of the cover band gigs that I was doing, any of the sort of like workman like gigs of going out and playing a solo acoustic show at happy hour for 3 hours to be ignored in the corner while people drink after their work week is done. Like, I'm just done with that. I don't need to
do it
thankless anymore.
And does not pay much.
No. And, you know, like a solo acoustic gig was one of the better paying slots where it was two early slots and I got home before the wee hours of the morning and I'd get $150. And like, that's just not worth it. Yeah. And band gigs a lot of times paid less than that. So as an income stream, it doesn't make sense. If you like doing it, you like hanging out in the bars, you like playing music with your friends, power to you. That's great. Just not where I'm at anymore.
Yeah,
so I'm actually, Yeah, I'm actually doing less now than I was doing before the pandemic and way happier about it. I'm mostly working in the recording studio with very occasional other stuff.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised, you know, a lot of the pros, local pros that I know teach lessons, but you mm-hmm. seem to have been spared that.
I did teach lessons for a little while. About 2 years when I worked at Herb David Guitar Studio, I taught private mm-hmm. lessons and I got burnt out on it because too many of it was like little Johnny got a guitar, yeah. bugged their parents to buy him a guitar. They got it. They realized it was work and mm-hmm. then they didn't really want to do it, but their parents made them keep taking lessons. Yeah. And I just realized I don't have the patience for that and I don't have the interest in that. So I quit. I just decided I'm done with lessons.
Well, yeah, Dave, it went kind of similar for me. It is something you better enjoy giving lessons because I think 9 out of 10 of your students are not going to be really all that interested.
Right.
Dave, I am
right.
kind of hoping that you, spend a day with me teaching me my music.
Yes, that is part of the plan for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a couple of students that were really good. There was this one kid who was like sort of a fan of punk and Bob Dylan, and he really just wanted to learn how to bash an electric guitar fast and furious, and he was way into it, and he was fun to teach. And then there was this other kid who later on got back in touch with me, and like he had moved to Austin and founded a little independent record label and was still playing all the time. And you know, he was a 15-year-old kid when I was teaching him lessons, and then to have him come back as an adult and tell me that, yeah, man, you made a really big difference in my life. Like you actually listened to me and that was really cool. That was great. Yeah. But it was the exception to my teaching experience.
Yeah, that is, I think it's all teaching is like that. You know, at the time you can't tell if you're making a difference or not. You won't know until a decade or two down the road.
Right.
And by then it's too late. So
yep.
Yeah, it is a little, it's tough. So it's almost all studio stuff now.
Yeah. And the schedule is starting to get busy again as things have opened up and right. people are feeling more comfortable going out into public. So yeah, it's, I'm back on, like I'm booked 3 weeks in advance and it just seems to keep filling up and new projects start coming in front of me, which is great. You know, you start doing something, the action of actually being involved and doing it generates more interest, I think. I think this is probably true of everything that you do.
Yeah.
You know, it's that old Field of Dreams thing, right?
Yep.
If you build it, they will come. And
yeah.
And being active, being visible because you're actually doing something, it's mm-hmm. self-perpetuating.
Yeah.
Tell me.
Now, how many projects do you have spinning now?
Oh, boy. You know, that's a little bit hard to answer because mm-hmm. it's a bunch. I have to look at my hard drive here and see what's not in my archive file.
Well, I know you're finishing up two projects right now with Barkin Broski and Barkin Roof Tales.
Yes, there's the Barkin Roof Tales. So, Mike, you came to me with percussion parts and a melody. Yeah. And nothing else. And you gave me this series of tapes. So all the albums we've done before, like these are songs that you had pretty well fleshed out and you knew basically what you wanted to do. And there were times where you'd say, oh, we did it with this band before and I didn't really like this. So we can, mm-hmm. we could, you know, break from that and do it a different way. But they were all pretty well already put together.
Yeah.
This time it was almost not put together at all. It was like bits of songs and bits of melody. And I got to just come up with all the musical background for it, which was a lot of fun. Yeah. And doing it during quarantine, I had time to like sit and dig into the tune for a day of just like exploring with the tune, which was really cool. So that's about finished up.
I'll tell you what I've heard from it. It sounds, I can't wait for the album to come out. I'll listen to the whole thing. I am really interested in the Barkin Roof, like a true collaboration now.
Yep. The first one we've done together that I'm putting my name on because it's been a real collaborative thing.
Yeah.
And the third Barker Brodsky album, the prequel,
Cold Country Heartbreakers.
He has the prequel to the Rock Opry.
Well, this is like what is this? It's like a reference in the rock opera about, so one of the characters has a band and these are the songs that that band played. I don't know if they will ever actually make it into the musical or not, but we'll see. So right. Yes, we're writing as a character from our stage musical.
Yep. And that's coming together. I've got a third album with Wolf Reuter that's sort of about halfway through. I could go on for the projects, but that would take a whole hour just to get through them all. I'm just doing a quick count of stuff that's open and still underway here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, that one just finished. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 albums that I'm working on right now.
Oh man.
Yeah. So,
and it's all word of mouth, isn't it? Pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much that and social media. You know, I get people that discover me there that I don't really know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, ultimately that's word of mouth too, right? It's, I know somebody, they know somebody.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Yep.
So a lot of people maybe doing what you do or musicians, you know, I guess around here, what they do is they go to Nashville and you stayed in a little town. What do you think is it valuable to go to like a music hotspot like that? Or
so I've had projects that went back and forth a bit here and there. And I've had a lot of people that come to record with me before or after going down there. Mm-hmm. And I think I've never myself worked in recording in Nashville. I've played gigs in Nashville, mm-hmm. but I've never been part of that music scene. And always been here in Michigan for me, with a couple of small exceptions. But the thing that they do differently there, there's a ton of recording studios for one, but they have a wealth of session musicians, and the session musicians there, it's extremely competitive to get the call to work. And that makes the caliber of those people like absolute top notch. Like they come in and you hand them a chart. There's actually a whole musical system called the Nashville Numbering System.
Oh, I love that. Is great notation. Really intuitive and easy to read. I like it. Right. I should learn it. I'm familiar with it. I don't know if I could play like really solid, but yeah, I need to practice with that.
Yeah, you probably could because you know some music theory. And if you know like the very basics,
it's all like
music
1, 4, 5 kind of, it's numbers.
Yep. And a minor song is starting on 6, not starting on 1 for the music theory nerds.
Oh, so everything is as in Ionian mode.
Yes.
And then, okay. Got it.
So if it was a song in the key of E and you go to a D natural chord, that's a flat 7 chord. So it is always in Ionian mode and everything modifies from there. But anyway, there's this whole music notation system that's come up around Nashville. And if you want to be a session musician, you have to be able to sit down, look at that chart in the Nashville numbering system and play a spot on album ready take, if not on the first take, by the second, and that's it. And in Michigan, yeah, like there's no time to rehearse and work stuff out, and you don't get rehearsal time. You show up at the session and you play amazing stuff from the first moment.
Or they don't, or you don't get called back. Is that
or you don't get
saying?
Called back. Right. There's 10 other people waiting to get the call and they'll be here in 15 minutes to replace you if you're not doing the gig. So that's a big difference. Like it's here stressful. In Michigan, I've got, you know, a couple of handful of session people that I know are going to do a great job. And there's a lot of other people who will come in and do session work where, you know, they're good people to be around. It's going to take a little longer. The result may not be quite as polished, and that's okay because it's about people and networking and the enjoyment of what's going on. But in Nashville, there's the huge pressure of everything has to be radio ready hit quality, and it's got to happen now, because you get a session with six session musicians that you're paying union scale to and paying $150 an hour for the recording studio. You know, it adds up expensive. Quick. Yeah. So that talent level of hired in, you know, guns for hire, that talent level is huge. And in Michigan, there's, you know, a very small group of people that are capable of doing that. And there are.
Well, you just play all the instruments. So typically,
right.
You only have to bring in somebody, what, if you need to play cello or something?
Yeah. Sarah Gibson does great work as a session cellist. But there's also advantage to having other people in a place like Michigan, because anyone that you bring in is probably also outperforming, and that's part of that whole networking thing. So very often, like I did a session Saturday with a newer client, and was it Saturday or was it yesterday? No, it was yesterday. And it was with somebody that we all know, Mill and Seth.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Millen's back working. He took a break over quarantine. We didn't do work, but so the album had sort of sat for a while untouched. And yesterday he came and started working again. And we were having this very discussion about, like, oh yeah, Dave, you could play guitar. I said, well, yeah, I can. I'd be happy to. I love your tunes. I definitely have ideas about stuff to play. Like, he was working on new scratch track for these four songs that he wrote over quarantine. And I'm sitting in here listening to the takes, playing along on my little classical guitar that's set right behind me. I got, hey Chris, I got a classical. Look at that.
Ooh, sexy.
It's a Yamaha, and technically a flamenco guitar.
Oh, nice. Yamaha make great equipment.
Yeah.
So I'm a fan of their guitars and stuff.
Yep. Great guitars for the money.
You know, Millen and I were talking about a project. So maybe this came up during our open mic, and he found some website where it's like the New York lyric songwriters.
That's what he was recording yesterday, were four of those songs.
He loves that. He's writing all sorts of songs to them. And we were talking about maybe doing a collaboration where we get a bunch of people and we all pick lyrics from this site, and then that's the theme of it. And I don't know, maybe get 5-10 people do one or two songs, and then
it's perfectly tied back to that point that, like, I could play guitar for him, I could do all the other instruments, but he's given up the opportunity to network at that point. So here, outside of Nashville and LA and New York, the big advantage of not having all of those highly skilled, highly paid session people is you can find people that are, you know, you're going to end up with friendships and collaborations and professional relationships with, that are going to help everybody tie together and help everybody build each other's creative output.
Right. Not just hired guns that show up for 5 minutes, you know, you've got a relationship.
Right. Or even just me as the hired gun, because you can't go on stage with five of me. It doesn't work.
Hard to network with one person. You know,
right.
Doesn't have the reach.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, I play a lot of instruments, but I don't really do that much on most of the records that I'm working with. It'll be like one thing and that's it, which is cool. I'm okay with that. I always tell people I'll play whatever parts you want me to play, and I'll be happy to do it, because I really am. It's a lot of fun. Or I'm happy to not. I'm happy to sit back and have somebody else come in and play, and I'll work with, you know, just the sounds, or coaching great takes, or working on arrangements or whatnot. But yeah, so that's the way I deal with that. And I think that networking thing is really valuable for anybody making records.
That's smart. Mike, we need to bring more people into our albums and network.
Not just your buddy Chad?
Well, I was thinking about our buddy Candy. Maybe for next album. Chad and I saw Candy out at Unity Vibrations the night after we played there.
Yeah.
Her and Cameron played. They had an awesome show.
Yeah.
So,
is nice to network in these ways. You know, I got to know so many people through open mics.
Yeah.
And then, you know, to go and watch a show, you know, somebody's CD release party. You know, I saw a lot of people I knew at Rod's CD release party. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just wonderful people out there.
Right. And, you know, there's a lot of these songwriting groups and collaboratives around too. There's like the Above the Bridge Retreat and the folks that are involved with the Trinity House. I guess it's a loose thing with the Songwriters Anonymous group, mm-hmm. and so many different groups of songwriters that get together and share stuff. And then a lot of them will end up playing on each other's projects. And mm-hmm. yeah, networking is so much of what it's about.
Yeah, I need to get into one of those songwriting groups or something. Me too. It might be nice, yeah, to get out, hear some other people. Though with our online open mic, I meet a lot mm-hmm. of them and hear a lot of their stuff anyway.
Yep, you did so a lot for nice. That. Yep, that's a big musical community through all of this, the last year of everybody being stuck at home.
I networked way more during lockdown than I ever would have in real life, you know?
Crazy, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. Crazy. I guess I love the internet.
During this lockdown or pandemic or whatever we're calling
call it. Call it shelter in place, I believe.
Yeah. I think it's given many of us an opportunity to really kind of take a second look and a third look and a fourth look at how we conduct our, not only our musical life, but the rest of our life in general. And
sure.
And kind of make some decisions about, you know, how we'd like to proceed from this point on.
Right. Yep. That's a huge thing. It definitely impacted me. That's a big part of why I'm not going back to playing all those gigs. I realized that, oh, I'm spending a lot more time with my family and I'm like really getting to know my kids better. And wow, I've missed a lot of this stuff. And it's been great. Totally yeah. love it. So I'm just sticking with it. I'm not going back.
Well, and Chris and I joked about how we, you know, we're saving a lot of money by not gigging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's truth to that. You know, even a gig where you make $100, you pay for gas, yep. you get fast food on the way there or the way home. Yep. Yep. You know, if you get drinks, even a coffee shop, right?
I'm tipping the wait staff.
Yep. Yep. Right. So yeah, that $100 gig, by the time you get home, not talking about mileage, you got $50 in your pocket, and then you write off your mileage. And you got nothing.
Right. So it's a lot of work.
And you spent 8 hours doing it.
I mean, right. So to us, I think the value is to promote our music. You know, now that we've got some decent recordings, thanks to your work, you know, now it's like, well, I guess I'd like people to hear them now.
Absolutely. You know? And there's huge value in that. And, you know, the performing that I'm continuing for myself is when I'm playing to support my recording clients, you know, those mm-hmm. times that I did play on their sessions and they're going to play gigs. That's how I started in the Judy Banker Band, which now has sort of a life of its own, but I played on Judy's recordings and then,
you played on stage.
We got to do a band to promote the stuff. So at first I was the bass player in the Judy Banker Band and now I'm sort of the multi-instrumentalist utility guy. I play some guitar and some keyboards and some accordion and who knows what else. But
well, one time you played drums for her, right?
I did. The regular drummer couldn't make the gig, Brian Williams. And yeah. I said, oh, well, you know, I can play and we don't need mm-hmm. to really do any special rehearsal because I already know all the songs. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I'm the catch-all in that project. Yeah. But yeah, it's original music is the thing that I'm still excited to go out and do. Like, oh, there's a good reason to do this. This is something new and different. Like, if people want to hear American Girl, they can put on the radio, you know, if they want to have a Green Day song played at them in a bar, mm-hmm. put on the radio or find somebody else to do it. I just don't want to do that stuff anymore.
Right.
Well, luckily for you, everybody is doing that, especially like, you know, wedding bands used to be such a huge moneymaker for musicians. If you had a couple weddings every weekend, you could almost live on that.
And there's now, that's still a real thing.
It's not nearly as big, though, you know?
No, there's this group that sort of has cornered the market in that in a lot of ways. Have you heard about the Blue Water Kings?
No, I haven't.
So it's a musical act. I say that, I guess, with air quotes, that it's a sort of a franchise of musical acts. They audition various musicians and they find the people that are capable of being like the session musicians to just come in and play. And they send out three or four or five different Blue Water Kings bands playing at weddings all around the state. and it's very sort of programmed and packaged, and they have band leaders that are like the key linchpins that lead the groups, and then it's a pickup group of a bunch of people playing with them who are all very top notch. Like, this is a high quality band. I got nothing bad to say about their professionalism. And I know some people that play in Blue Water Kings, and two of them who are Blue Water Kings people who I know quite well have never played a gig together and never even met in person, except they did one showcase where like event planners came in to see the band play, and they did this showcase together, but have never actually gone out on a gig together. Cause there's five bands every weekend playing someone's wedding.
That makes sense with weddings. This is not the time to get original. You know, you need to give the bride what she wants. And it is something that they probably have a formula, and you just do that and you play it well and everyone's just happy.
Corporate musicians.
It is.
Yeah. Yep. Pretty much. And, you know, making it small in music, right? That's another path. You figure out how to do that and how to play that role and look right and smell right. And, you know, show up at the gig and don't tick anybody off, and
show up to the gig sober.
That's important.
I hear that's a plus.
Yeah. Yeah. Not all musicians can handle that.
But
I don't know. I mean, I would think out gigging. Well, you were talking too about balancing a family and music, and out gigging can be tough, especially if you have to travel a lot.
Yeah.
But I mean, it isn't a big deal here other than practicing, you know, practicing at home and forcing everybody to listen to that racket.
Speaking of that, balancing family, right on cue, my lights flashed, which means someone's trying to get my attention. So I'm going to pause, and this will be a cue for an edit again for you. Let me see what's going on. I think we're just about done anyway.
So yeah, we can wrap it up.
I think it's my youngest wanting to say goodnight, but let's see. Good night time?
Yes. Night-night.
Night-night. Have a good school day tomorrow. Be an exciting one.
Good night, Michael.
Yes, that's exactly what was going on. Balancing music and family.
There you go.
Hold on.
I'm not even cutting that out. It's perfect.
that was a great cue. But, you know, Dave, it's been great talking to you. You know, of course, we talk to you pretty regularly, but this is...
Yeah, that way different. I felt good about this. I've talked to Dave many times, so this should be easy.
Yeah.
Right.
And by the way, you know what? I keep calling you Dave. Is it David? Do you prefer David?
I don't have a preference. When I was a kid, it was always David, and then later somebody started calling me Dave, and that was fine. And I usually introduce myself to people in a new situation as David, because when I was doing telephone sales, one of my day gigs that I did through all of this, I was an inside sales rep for a music distributor. And I found that when I introduced myself on the phone and I said, "This is Dave."
Dave's not here.
Well, no, there's that.
You wouldn't get that?
Well, once in a while, but what I got more often than not is, "This is Dave" became Steve. This is Steve. This is Dave. Steve. It's that elision of the S and the D became something else. And it actually just happened earlier today. The guy who tunes my piano had taken my voicemail saying I needed to schedule a piano tuning. And I said, "This is Dave. I need to talk to you about getting a piano tuning." And he called me and he said, "Hi, is this Steve?" But I frankly don't care, Dave or David.
Right. Well, I'm going to put your name in the title, so I'll do it David Roof then.
I just won't call you Bob.
Yeah, don't call me Bob. That's my father-in-law's name, and he's excommunicated.
I guess let's wrap it up. You know, at the end of this, we usually announce who we're going to talk to next month, but we don't know. You have anybody have any good suggestions?
You should see if you could get Mike Gentry.
Yeah. Oh, yes. That would be great.
Yeah, he'll talk to you. He loves to talk for an hour.
He loves to talk.
Yeah,
I'll shoot him a message. You know,
I'm more worried about getting people that want to talk than, you know, I don't care how musical somebody is. If they play music, I really want to get a wide variety. Maybe some people who only occasionally go to an open mic. and up to, you know, folks like you. But yeah, I just want people that can speak.
Yep.
Yeah, I'll shoot him a message either tonight or tomorrow and see if he's interested.
Yeah, if he's busy or whatnot, you know, I end up bumping elbows with a lot of people, so I can throw you a bunch of different names.
Yeah,
we got all our guys from the online open mic, too.
Oh, yeah.
Tom Alter is doing Trinity,
yep.
I think, coming up this next week. So he works a lot, but he is not a talker. I worry that, you know, getting Tom to talk, he might need a lot of encouragement. He's so soft-spoken.
Well, between the couple of us, we do know quite a few people.
Right. I think this is going to be a good thing. It's cool that you guys are doing this, and it's part of that whole community building thing, right? Like
social media, networking.
Yep. And
we elevate each other. Raising water lifts all boats. Isn't that the cliche, something like that?
I love it. I love cliche. Being we're conspirators, not competitors.
Wait, there you go.
Maybe something better than conspirator.
Colleagues.
Thank you. Yeah. Co-conspirators. You know, you could have a conspiracy for something good. It doesn't have to be nefarious.
I think they just call it a plan at that point, though.
Okay.
Well, Dave, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for asking me.
Barker and Broski. Yep. Any last thoughts you'd want to share with, you know, the three or four listeners?
Hey, this could be big in 10 years and they could be coming back and listening. So any words to people in the future?
We're making it small in music. No, I think it's all about having fun, expressing yourself, giving voice to your own inner muse. And, you know, if you got something to say, get out there and say it, because we all want to hear it. Music is communication in a sense. Yeah. Songs certainly are communication. Yeah. So it's we weave the fabric of our culture together, one piece of art at a time. So I'm
that's
all for it. And
I'm
a fan. You know, I'm a fan of all the music that's being made here in Michigan. Yeah. We have a really cool thing. And I think if we can continue to get that message out to the rest of the country, it's just going to make music the next big thing here in Michigan, because we really do have a lot of creative talent and a lot of active creative talent. So
agreed.
It's a pleasure to be part of this and to be part of this community. And thanks, guys. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for having me.
Oh man, it was a great time. I always appreciate your input and experience. And thanks for helping us out with our podcast.
You're very welcome.
And Dave, I'll see you Friday.
You got it. See you then.